we decided to do a little experiment, a side project, and this may or may not even be in your ears because we're not sure we're going to share it, but we're giving it a go. And one of our passions is obviously our connection with our spiritual life, and so we decided that each week we would try to do a really kind of short and irreverent, maybe a little reverent, I don't know, we'll see
how it goes. I hope it's reverent.
discussion of the section of the Bible that we're reading for the week. If you're not familiar with Jewish tradition, the first five books of the Bible and even the prophets and the writings are broken down into segments so that you can read through all of it in one year. And the whole of the Jewish community does this all at the same time. So it's kind of neat. Anytime you go into a different place of worship throughout the year, everyone is reading the same part of the scripture at that time.
So, it's called the Torah portion.
The Torah portion. So yeah. If you didn't know already, that's what we are talking about. Yeah. We happen to be towards the end of Exodus. If we were really good planners, we would have started it at the beginning of the new Torah cycle.
But right.
That's not how we operate. No. So anyway, we're towards the end of Exodus. So the people have already left Egypt, the Israelites, and they are moving through the desert and they're building the tabernacle, and that's what's happening. So in this particular portion, there's a lot of nitty gritties into how the construction of that tabernacle should look, who should do what. What it should look like exactly. I mean, the blueprint is very, very clear. And one reading it today, those of us who don't have a tabernacle, it seems really, I don't know, hard to grasp, maybe?
Hard to grasp, yeah.
Or what is the meaning of this for my life?
Right. And I think what I want to dive into right away
buckle up, guys.
Is we just left the golden calf, right? The Israelites just made the mistake of the golden calf. Moses disappeared. They say to Aaron, we don't know where God is anymore. Moses is gone. Mm. We need to make something to replace him. And interestingly enough, for those of you who aren't familiar with rabbinic tradition, we're going to be diving into a lot of rabbinic tradition, which is kind of, they fill in a lot of blanks. So if you want to believe that those are 100% factual,
well, the truth is, it's like a teacher. Rabbi just means teacher, so it's a teacher's interpretation. And I think we can always learn from people and what they get from it. So we're not looking at this as like our, you know, religious precepts necessarily, but they are potentially nuggets that we can learn from and apply.
And if nothing else, it makes really fun, like, filler stories. Mm-hmm. But so rabbinic tradition says that of the people that worshiped the golden calf, there were only 3,000 out of the 400,000 Israelites. So it was a small minority of people, but they were able to influence all of Israel.
Mm.
And we get to this Torah portion.
Except for the women. The Mishnah says the women did not agree, and therefore the new moon celebration belongs to the women. Now that's, again, just a rabbinic tradition, but the women did not agree to give their gold for the building of the golden calf. And so I don't know. I think that's a fun little sidebar.
I feel like that's perfectly reasonable. Generally, men are the ones doing the stupid things. But we dive into this Torah portion, and at the end of every section where it says, gives a little bit of a detail, it says, as the Lord had commanded Moses, and it actually says that 18 times throughout this Torah portion. Each little section, it says, as the Lord commanded Moses.
Mm.
And what I was learning in another Torah study was that, to think about it this way, the Israelites had just built this golden calf and made a major blunder by trying to substitute for God and create their own, like, God, essentially. But when we get to this part, what our Torah teacher or mentor was teaching us was that most likely you see this so many times in the Torah portion because it was like almost like checking it off, like, okay, build this part because God said to build this part, and build, like, you're okay, you're in the safe zone essentially of like, the Lord is telling you to do this, not necessarily.
Oh, right.
You know, like,
don't just go off on your own,
right,
whatever prerogative. And I mean, the influence of the golden calf all came from this idol worship of Egypt, where they left, and
right,
they were meant to leave that behind. You know, there's a lot of like story overlap between many of the biblical stories of like the struggle of leaving where you came in from, like this place of worshiping idols, and trying to not look back or take those traditions with you into the next place. I know Abraham struggles with it, and you've got Sodom and Gomorrah, and wives turning into pillars of salt. You know, like this is something that happens again and again. It's really hard for us to leave what's comfortable, even when we know it's not good for us, and move into something that is better for us, fully releasing that thing and leaving it behind. And that's kind of like, okay, you want to build something for me, and I appreciate that, but you cannot do it with what you were using before to worship idols. It just can't, it cannot be true that, you know, right. I'll accept those same things.
And it's like this, listening and hearing God and doing what God commands. Like another example is Nadab and Abihu, mm-hmm. which are Aaron's sons. Like they get this like wild hair, and they're like, "Hey, we'll just bring this fire offering." Where God says, "Like there's a very specific way that you bring this," and they get zapped, Shazammed dead. You know,
yeah.
Like they're like God's like, "Nope, that's not how you do it." Even though like they're Aaron's sons, and like that, you would think maybe they would get a little bit of. Grace on that, but you know, like there's a very specific way that you do things and a very specific order to things, mm-hmm. and that's
well, and
I
it's
think
interesting.
What this is teaching us,
we have like the golden calf, like compared to what the temple actually ends up being made of largely. And it was, I have this Nachman book, which is, he's a rabbi that was sort of a naturalist hippie guy.
Yeah.
From, I don't know, the Middle Ages. I'm not even sure when he lived, but he generally is known to be one of these kind of like tree loving hippie dippy rabbis that not everyone approves of, but that's okay. Cause I that happens to be my particular genre.
Hippy dippy and hippie. Not approved of.
Yeah. Anyway, it just says that the Mishkan, which Mishkan is the Hebrew word for tabernacle, is an acronym for Mitah, which means bed, Shulchan, which means table, Kisai, and please, if you're a Hebrew speaker, please forgive my Hebrew.
Send all corrections to lacey@theschoolhouselife.com.
Anyway, Kisai, which means chair, Ner, which means lamp. And these are all mundane objects that are absolutely necessary for our lives in this world, but they can also help us attain awesome spiritual heights if we know how to use them properly. And what I think about that is like, oh my goodness, so we're making this temple out of our daily ritualistic things that we do regardless of if we're, you know what I mean? It's like part of our daily lives, and we're just bringing an elevated version into the tabernacle where we come to convene with the Creator, you know? So it's like,
yeah.
It's not a golden calf or some, like, I mean, there's beautiful imagery on the tapestries and the ark itself, but you know, for the most part, it's taking these really mundane objects and elevating them. And what do we bring in there? Foods that we eat every day, right? Breads and the meat that they eat every day. I mean, it all is just a part of this process of, like, I don't think the Creator even wants us to do anything extravagant or extraordinary. It just, he just wants to be a part of all of that, what we're already doing.
That's interesting because, I mean, you know, the Torah says that we are also a holy priesthood, and that the tabernacle is also within us.
Well, and obviously so, like, we don't have a tabernacle right now, right. For the most part, so it's, we can't experience this.
Yeah,
in that way.
I think like the point of, that you were saying of, mm-hmm. it being so basic and so like almost mundane, like it's all the simple things that we interact with every day.
And then we know how to interact with. Yeah. You know, I would walk up to a golden calf and be like, I don't know what to do here.
Right. That's like something set apart.
Tell me what to do.
Right. Something set apart, yeah. Where this is like, these are basic things, just like in our body. Like, we should also remember that, like, our body is a temple, mm-hmm. is the tabernacle also. And how do we treat and interact with that on our own selves,
right.
And then our interaction with each other? If we're all, like, you know,
well, it even comes back to that, yeah, approachability of what the Creator wants, this, like, intimate and real relationship that, you know, you walk into a person's house and it almost doesn't even matter what culture they are. You see a table, you see a chair, you know what to do, right?
There's,
it's not something where you feel like somebody has to teach you or it's like a foreign thing. This is something that spans across almost all cultures, and immediately you feel, when you're sitting at the table with other people, as if you're equal and as if you're meant to be there and a part of that, whatever is happening at that table, communing together. So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I've never really thought about it, how simple the temple really is. I mean, it's got a space, like a room for hanging out.
Right.
And then it's got the more holy spaces where you put the holier things. And these the eternal flame of the menorah, and then you've got this separated room that's special and holy and isn't meant to be treated as if just an everyday in and out kind of situation, the Holy of Holies. So I don't know, like, I just think that's a really interesting, we talked about that too, like when Yom Kippur comes up, and it's traditionally thought that that's the day where somebody would enter the Holy of Holies. And if you think of that as like the innermost parts of our heart where we don't always let people in, or we hold it sacred and safe and special and keep it kind of protected on a lot of different levels, physically, spiritually, all of those things. I don't know how the body and the temple line up, I think, is really important also.
Yeah, no, yeah, it makes sense. I think, like, I was just kind of thinking on the other, like, level of completely different kind of...
Here we go.
My brain went somewhere else. of just, like, we're... Also, at this point, the Israelites have come out of Egypt, and they were Egyptian, essentially, and pretty comfortable there. And now we're going to this spot where we're creating...
Well, let's explain the pretty comfortable, because I don't know that everyone is on the same page there. Because we've been talking about this a good amount. We've heard it over the years. And I just heard it reiterated yesterday, so Drew and I were talking about it. But how many people left Egypt? How many of the Israelites actually left Egypt? And how many essentially died during the last
plague?
They
weren't willing to kill the...
They didn't mark their doorposts.
Yeah, they weren't willing to kill the lamb. Right. The lamb was a sacred animal for the Egyptians. So for them to,
and
like...
In that culture.
Yeah, in that culture.
Kind of like a cow in India, maybe?
Right. So for them to, like, stake it out front in their yard and be like, we're going to kill this, like... I don't know what the equivalent would be in America. Probably, like, McDonald's or something. Yeah. I don't know. But, you know, like...
Yeah. It was a line in the sand.
You're right. They were saying, like, we are going to kill your favorite animal.
Yeah,
like,
and it's...
You're a deity, essentially.
It's accepted, and it says it, although I haven't looked for myself, but I'm assured by the teachers I was listening to that it does say it in there. But 80% of the Hebrews did not participate in that part of the commandments, and so they therefore suffered from the last plague, which was death, right? So 80%. And the argument is, you know, yes, they were slaves and they had heavy work, but they also had homes and food, and they were comfortable, and they knew that life, and they didn't want to go to the desert. They were like, yeah, you go, that's fine, maybe we'll catch you later, maybe we'll come visit, but they were not willing or eager to leave, and so they didn't, and therefore they missed out on an opportunity in a really massive way, which that goes back to just what you were saying of, like, you know, they were, you said they were comfortable in Egypt. I don't think everyone thinks that they were comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hollywood doesn't really portray it that way.
I think comfortable is how were they comfortable? They knew what they had there.
Yeah, they knew what they had.
They
knew what to expect.
They were well fed. They were well sheltered.
And, like, you can kind of see, like, to prove that point, like, throughout the Torah portion, like, all the way until they get to the Promised Land, and then when they complain about they're not going to make it in the Promised Land, they continuously say, you know, like, we should have gone back to Egypt. When they get to the Red Sea, it's like, why did you bring us here to die? We would have been better off in Egypt. There's, like, lots of complaining about, like, you know, life was better in Egypt, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But so we're getting to, like, this point where we're starting to form a nation, which fascinates me that still an agricultural-based nation that is being formed without a land. Like, there's a promise of a land, but the land isn't there yet.
They didn't, you know, we talked about this in one of the recent episodes of like, true freedom is having that connection with the land. And so anytime you're separated from it, you've lost autonomy. You now are dependent on some other human to do that which is necessary for you to survive with the land. Whether, if you're not doing it, someone is. I mean, you have to survive. And if somebody else is doing it and you don't have the ability to do it, then it is a form of slavery because you are reliant on that other person or, you know, person's business, whatever it is. And so they're being stripped away of this, like, security of knowing what their work is, which has to do with, you know, heavy labor, and doesn't have to be to do with farming and doesn't have to do with raising animals per se. It's to do with this heavy building of pyramids situation. And so now they're leaving, and I think they're kind of getting a deep dive, like almost a cleanse in the desert. And it turns out they need a long time with that to really be cleaned up, I guess.
Well, yeah, and so now, like, we had a couple of things for this forming of the nation. The first thing was, like, any good nation needs a common enemy, and we have Amalek. So, you know, that's their, like, common enemy. They go to war. That binds them together. They win. And then they start building this tabernacle. Mm-hmm. So the other thing a nation needs is, like, a common religion. And now, like, they have this focus on the tabernacle. But the neat thing about this tabernacle that you don't see with a lot of other religions is that God says to Moses, for everybody, men, women, children, slaves, everybody to bring an offering for this tabernacle. So everybody together builds this tabernacle. When this tabernacle is complete, anybody and everybody can look at it and say, I had a part in building this. And it's mobile. But to me, I think the point of it is it's like a practice for when they get to Jerusalem, they're going to be able to plop this down. They've got their common enemy and their wars. You know, they've got their common religion now. And they, like, that's already aside. They're already, like, a tight-knit people. And they can go and, you know, live in this promised land that and do those things. But, like, their relationship with God is, like, being built at this point. But their relationship with each other is also being solidified in
every
aspect.
Well, how do they do something together that is their decision? Is of their, right? Because when you're a slave, you're just doing what you're told to do.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're getting by, but this is a whole new experience of freedom that you know, once you don't have freedom for an extended period of time, it's going to be really hard to strap that on and wear it.
Yeah.
And then you can see they struggle with that. And so this is like, okay, this is how you be free. You work together.
Yeah.
And there's no one who's above or below. And I think that is actually one of the things I never really noted before. And something that makes me uncomfortable just in general with, like, giving opportunities where it's like, it's one thing if you're going to be a sponsor and you're putting your name on something because you want your name to be seen, right?
For a business opportunity.
But when you're doing a private donation and, like, it's a tithe or a, you know, I have heard it said that a lot of people came at cover of dark because they wanted to give what they could give without being seen, without there being some kind of tally sheet.
Right.
And I don't think there was a tally sheet. I think it was really
it's funny because you think about it now and it would be like, okay, like if you give 1,000 shekels, your name will be across the entranceway. Instead it was like, everybody bring what you can. And in fact, it was so much that they had to say, stop bringing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're good, we got enough.
And can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that just is, like, solidifies the idea.
Think about any fundraiser program. Like, if...
Right. Don't tell people what to give.
Yeah.
Well, or don't... Yeah, I don't know. It's
like,
interesting.
Well, we got so much we don't need anymore. Like,
oh, that would be lovely. Please stop giving us.
Yeah.
You know, I can't even imagine. Yeah, that's all really
interesting. The other one quick little note that I found fascinating was, so the main guy that is put in charge of this, he is like...
Bezalel
is, I'm trying to think, he's like in charge of the creativity, the design, like he's the one that is inspired by God for how to lay out the tabernacle and everything like that.
Oh, here his backstory though, because what I read in the commentary last week, his father was, I think it was Hur.
Yeah.
And his father, Hur, was against the golden calf. And he said, no, no, no. And the mob that wanted to create the golden calf killed him. So he died.
Killed Hur?
Hur, yeah. Killed
H-U-R.
H-U-R, the father of Bezalel. And so Bezalel is like gifted in this beautiful way to build and create. And they say that, of course, that seems like a direct correlation with the suffering that his father was put through for being obedient, for having the wisdom to say, no, let's not do this, and being killed as a result of doing that. And his son was able to be the one who had his major fingerprint kind of on the creation of this and in the history, like the book.
And Oliab. I feel like we got to mention him. But do you know how old Bezalel was?
33. 17. Oh, my gosh. But so, that's so interesting because he probably had to be that young. He wasn't that indoctrinated yet, you know? One of those young whippersnappers who can...
Yeah. I just thought that was really fascinating. I was
if his father was such a great, like, had this... You know, he was clearly raised in a household where... his faith in the spiritual side of things is pretty clear. And I don't know, like there's a lot to that.
And the fact that, like, you know, even like there's no, there's no like hierarchy or
ageism
class or like, you know, it's not like Bezalel is from the tribe of Judah and Eliab is from the tribe of Dan. You know, they're not Levites. They're not from even from, you know, some of the
like Aaron better, and Moses
better tribes. Yeah, Aaron and Moses.
You would think.
Like that was something else funny that somebody said was like, do you know what happened to Moses' children? Like, where are they when they get to the promised land? Do you know?
I kind of remember somebody saying we specifically don't know.
Yeah,
but
the Torah doesn't say anything about them. It's just kind of a, like, you know, so, like, there's a very, like, equal opportunity, I guess is what I was saying, is, like, you know, like you said, ageism. Like, if you were inspired by God, you were inspired by God. There wasn't, like, any requirement to be of, like, a lineage or anything like that.
Yeah, that's really kind of a beauty. It's like a barn raising.
Right. It is. It really is.
Yeah. So anyway, well, I feel like that's a lot to tinker on. I would love for you to, like, I did have one question, and I would love for anyone who's listening to answer us either by way of reaching out privately through messages on social or on YouTube, wherever you're watching or listening. Unfortunately, podcasts should really have comments underneath, but they don't.
I think Spotify might now.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, cool. If you're using Spotify, then feel free to leave a comment there. But
and then we'll figure out how to find
it. Or you can leave a review, and in your review you can say something, and maybe we'll figure that out. But anyway, so my question is the golden calf was built. Obviously, there was, like, that was not good. Was the tabernacle part of God's plan from the start, or did he see what the people were doing and what the people needed and say, okay, here's what you need and let me help you design it, you know?
Oh, like, that's a good one.
Was it the plan from the beginning, or was it a modification of the plan in order to meet the needs of the people? Not that he didn't foresee it, but that...
I knew that.
You know, like, it's such a hard question.
Right. Yeah, to say that God didn't see
it. An all-knowing God didn't know that we would need a tabernacle? No, right. I don't know. Therein lies the question.
All right. Till next time.